Today, we're going to explore one of the lesser-known events leading up to the Zoot Suit Riots, the murder of Jose Diaz at Sleepy Lagoon. I've got a great guest on board for the show today. This is the Lowrider Samurai Podcast. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to the Lowrider Samurai. Here's your host, Brandon Lauren Maxwell.
My guest today is a professor of history at Arizona State University and a former host of the popular PBS series History Detectives. He is a frequent guest lecturer on topics such as the American West, Latinos in the United States, American youth subculture, and American religion. He is also the author of multiple books, including the one we're going to talk about today, entitled The Murder at Sleepy Lagoon, Zoot Suits, Race, and Riot in Wartime L.A., a book that documents the 1942 Sleepy Lagoon murder trial in Los Angeles, which led to the wrongful conviction of 17 Mexican-American youth for the alleged gang slaying of Jose Diaz. And this would become just one of many events in the lead-up to the Zoot Suit Riots, and that's why it matters. His name is Eduardo Pagan. Mr. Pagan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So before we dive too deep into Sleepy Lagoon and the incident that happened and Jose Diaz and why his murder matters, why don't you go ahead and set the scene at the time for our listeners?
Well, in terms of kind of, you know, trying to get ourselves back into what the domestic, what the home life was like in the 1940s, particularly in 1942, I would say there's a couple of things that you need to keep in mind. One is the war wasn't going well for the American forces, for the Allied forces. And, you know, that wasn't common knowledge. It wasn't published in the newspaper headlines. But what you didn't see is you didn't see a lot of news and a lot of information about how well the war was going. There wasn't a lot of news about advances or fronts that were advancing towards towards Berlin. And so, you know, there's a lot of concern. You know, and I guess I would say this, is that often we in the present, we look back at the past and assume that what happened was a foregone conclusion. But when you're living in the moment, you have no idea what's going to happen next. And when you're involved in a worldwide war, there's a lot of anxiety about how this is all going to turn out. So there's that in terms of the international scene. But I would also say in terms of the home scene, the home front, the war effort had a tremendous impact on social relations. It completely upended everything. Everything that was considered normal before the war was gone. And it was primarily because this was an all-out effort, and all able-bodied men were marshaled in one form or another to fight this war. You know, either they were sent abroad or they were drafted in the support mission of the army and the military. And so with all of these men moving into the military, they're out of the American workforce, and that necessitated women moving into the workforce. And so right away, you've got a dramatic change in American society and American economy in terms of women moving into the workforce in unprecedented ways and unprecedented numbers. And what's interesting, and one of the things that I do when I start off on a research project is I just read all the newspapers that I can. And I just start from one day and just keep reading because I want to know what's on the minds of people. What are they reading? What are they thinking about? And I pay particular attention to the letters to the editors. And it's very, very clear that in the early 1940s, particularly 1942, there's a lot of anxiety, a lot of discussion about what they characterized as juvenile delinquency. They didn't use the term latchkey children, but that captures exactly what people were concerned about. In other words, dad's off fighting the war, mom's in the factory making all the munitions. Who's watching over the children, and what are they doing with their time? And so there was a lot of discussion about uncontrolled children, and that, you know, that society, home front society, was falling apart because the traditional figures that would be in charge of that were no longer around.
Okay, so I think that's really interesting right there, because aside from the change in the workforce that was happening. Nationalism, like you said, was on the kind of, it was an all-out effort on behalf of the U.S. government to kind of create this unified nation. And there were also policies that were implemented, like rationing. Am I correct? That had to do with cloth and things like that. So now that manifested itself, in addition to, I guess, the national sentiment, in a lot of, I think, anti-Mexican-American sentiment, in addition to the perceived delinquency at the time. Am I correct?
Yeah, in a very curious kind of way, it did. Yeah, it wasn't it was one of the multiple social tensions that was at work during this time. Yeah.
Okay. So what was the difference between the perceived delinquency at that period during the war and gangs that had previously existed prior to the war?
Well, you know, there's a very interesting discussion among scholars, and I would even call it a debate, whether, you know, these groups of young people were gangs or not. From my perspective, I tend to side on the side that they were not gangs in any way that we think of gangs today.
Right.
You know, when we think of gangs, we're so used to thinking about the Bloods and the Crips, about MS-13, in compared to what we think of as gangs. These kids weren't gangs in the 1940s. That's my perspective. I mean, there would be other arguments to the contrary.
No, I think I would agree with you, because you had you have, I think, neighborhoods you have that became what they are now, became larger gangs. But I feel like in the late 1800s, where some of the oldest neighborhoods can be traced to, like Dogtown Reefa, for example, 38th Street, Big Hazard, all these gangs that started in the early 1900s, late 1800s. They weren't necessarily what we saw today. They were neighborhoods that might have been segregated and whatnot. You had car clubs, you had family names and things like that. But what changed, I think, as a result of the war?
Again, going back to, if you could put your, as much as we can in the present, if we put our minds in the 1940s, that term itself, gang, was very consciously used by the critics of young people who had a lot of free time on their hands and who were unsupervised. And the term was a very loaded term coming out of the 1930s when you spoke of gangs, you thought of Al Capone. And so to kind of splash them with that same taint or that same paint was an effort to try and demonize young kids that, from my perspective, they were just neighborhood kids who were hanging out with each other. And they were just trying to find ways of coping with life. So it was a very loaded term to be using in the 1940s, but it was used intentionally as a way of trying to demonize young people. Now, the question about how does race come into this, and it's one of the complicated strands. The language about gangs and the characterization of juvenile delinquents wasn't limited to only young people of color back in the 1940s. There was a lot of press about white kids as well, working class white kids. Where things get really interesting goes when you start dealing with Mexican-American youth in particular as the children of immigrants, and these are the children of refugees from the Mexican Revolution. And so now you've got this language, it's already loaded, gangs, that's being applied to young kids. And then you've got anti-immigrant sentiment that's also coming out of the 1930s and 1920s. You know, this is a period of 100% Americanism, right? So there's this echo of all of that coming to play in the 1940s. It's also tangling up into the social tensions of this particular period. So it takes a particular slant when it's used with Mexican-American kids. But, you know, I would say this as well, the 30th Street kids, I mean, this was what we might characterize as an integrated neighborhood. They weren't all Mexican-Americans. There were Jews, there were Armenians, there were working-class white kids as well in this group. So they weren't this wasn't a Mexican-American neighborhood per se.
Right. A lot of people don't know that. A lot of people don't talk about that.
Yeah. See, and this is kind of interesting about how this historic moment has come to be preserved in the popular consciousness. Most people, if they access this moment, they do so through the movie Zoot Suit Riot or the play. And, you know, that was written in a very particular moment of time of kind of a cultural nationalism. And Luis Valdez, you know, wrote this he began thinking about this in the 1960s and wrote this play in this moment of cultural ferment among Mexican Americans who wanted to make a particular statement about who they were. And so he read backwards into his history, or into the history of California, a lot of 1960s assumptions. And so, yeah, you get this kind of characterization that this moment is exclusively Mexican-American, and it's not. Hmm. The tensions are much broader than that.
So with Jose Diaz, who's the focus of this murder that we're kind of talking about, or was a focus of the book you wrote about the murder at Sleepy Lagoon, who was he at that time?
Oh, Jose Diaz. The best that I could piece together was that, you know, he was just a good kid. He was the oldest brother of a large family. He himself was the son of refugees from the Mexican Revolution. He came to the United States when he was 2 years old, and so this was the only country he ever really knew. And he grew up working in the fields of Southern California. And by all accounts, he was kind of like the older brother that everyone wished they had. He looked out for his brothers and sisters. He was a good son. I mean, he was just a good kid all the way around.
So he had just no history leading up.
No. He was not the kind of kid that would be hanging around on street corners. He had no history with the LAPD. He was a good kid. I mean, again, he worked hard. He shared his wages with his family, you know, pulled their wages together. I mean, he was just, there was nothing negative that could really be said about Jose Diaz. Like I said, he was just a good kid all the way around.
Okay. So one night in Commerce, California, that's where Sleepy Lagoon was located. Am I correct? At that time?
You know, probably, and the reason why I say this is because, you know, I've gone to locate the site, and I'm pretty sure that I've located the site. There's a business park on it now.
Right.
Which municipality does it fall in? Is it? I'm not exactly sure which one it falls into, but you're probably right. Yeah, it's Commerce or somewhere very close to it.
Okay. So Jose one night is found. Is he bleeding on the side of the road from stab wounds?
Yeah, so Jose, you know, as I said, he grew up, this is the country's only country he's ever known. He was not subject to the draft, as far as I know, because he was not an American citizen, but he volunteered nonetheless. And he was going to report on a Monday morning, and there was a birthday party that was held on a Saturday night. And if my memory serves me correctly now, this was 2nd of August, 1942. And Jose was living out in what was then rural California. It's not rural anymore, but back in the 1940s it was. And it was a large ranch, and there were a number of families that lived on this ranch, and they worked the fields. And these ranch families got together to celebrate a birthday party of one of the young girls that was living on there. And Jose was included because he was part of this little nexus of working families that lived on this ranch. It was called the Williams Ranch. And so the party goes on. It's a typical Mexican party, you know, lots of food. They had a little orchestra playing, beer flowing as well. Everything goes as, you know, and there were parents and children, you know, I mean, this is just several families getting together. Nothing suspicious about this particular party. What happens about 11 o'clock at night, there's a group of boys from Downey, and they themselves were, I've later come to find out, were largely immigrant youths, European immigrants. They were working class kids.
European immigrants.
They came, European immigrants, yeah, yeah, Russian, some of them. They came and they crashed the party. They wanted beer. They were thrown out of the party. They weren't invited guests. And as they were thrown out of the party, they drove out. And again, this is on dirt roads. And on the way out, they accost some kids who are off in the distance, who are necking in a car. And this is something that the Downey boys were known to do. In fact, they were known at Downey as the Chain Gang, right? This was how they were known. And there's a fight that takes place, which I'll have to come back to later on. Mm-hmm. But so from the perspective of Jose Diaz, though, there's nothing negative that happens at this party until this moment about 11 o'clock. These gate crashers come, they're thrown out. Party continues on until about 1 o'clock in the morning. By that time, most people kind of go home. Jose is he's one of the last people to be seen at the party. He's drunk by this point. And I should add that he's not a drinker. He didn't drink beer. But I suspect what happened was because he's going into to join the army, a lot of people were probably saying, here, have one on me. And they were probably giving him money as a gift, well wishes. So he had money on him, and he was drunk. And we know he was drunk by the forensic evidence as well. He was pretty drunk, pretty smashed. And he was last seen leaving the party in the company of two other young men who lived on this ranch about 1 o'clock in the morning. He is next found bleeding and mortally wounded on the side of a dirt road. But that's where the story gets very, very complicated, Dan, about who who beat Jose Diaz.
Now, he wasn't dead yet, correct? He was still alive?
He was still alive. By the medical reports, he could kind of barely answer some questions about who he was. But he never really gained full consciousness after that point.
So he's never able
he
to
died
identify...
About four... No.
Okay, so they take him to the hospital. Now, this creates a panic at the time, right? Because this was one of what was perceived by the public to be a number of incidences between youth.
Yeah, so that weekend was an unusually violent weekend in Los Angeles. There were a number of other clashes between young people. And I wouldn't say they were all Mexican-American. These are working-class whites. Just a number of youth violent activities on that particular weekend. And when he died, this is when the Attorney General sent down a mandate to the LAPD, but also to the LA Sheriff's Office, to do something about this, to do something about youth gangs that were getting out of control. So what happens then was that his death becomes politicized. And the law enforcement agencies of Los Angeles and Los Angeles County become invested in trying to find the murderers of Jose Diaz and prosecute them with the full extent of the law.
Mm. Now, had they done roundups yet? Is this what preceded the roundups they eventually did? Okay. So what happened?
Yeah, to my knowledge, they had not done roundups. To my knowledge, this was the first, and so both the sheriff's department and they took care of the county, and then the LAPD they took care of the city. They did roundups. They just swept through all of the working class neighborhoods and the rural neighborhoods of both Los Angeles County, but also Los Angeles, and just picked kids up off the street and processed them through their system. Fingerprinted them, took their pictures, booked them, held them. And there were mass roundups of young people, all in an effort to try and figure out who killed Jose Diaz. And eventually, in the process of questioning young people, the neighborhood of 38th Street was identified as the ones who were responsible for Jose Diaz's death. But I should say that, this was very common in the 1940s that, questioning wasn't just sitting you down in a room and saying, okay, tell us what you know. This was usually asking that question after you were slapped around a couple times or even hit with a fist or with a blackjack. I mean, they were pretty rough in the 1940s. This was long before your Miranda rights.
Mm. Right. And they rounded up, I think, 500 plus people.
To 600. Quite a few.
People. And when they rounded those people up, were they predominantly Mexican Americans, or did that also kind of span different ethnicities?
It spanned different ethnicities, but again, when you're dealing with working class neighborhoods, the majority of them are going to be Mexican American. Mm-hmm. But we're also talking about other immigrants who are living in Los Angeles. Los Angeles is a very diversified city at this time, as it still is today. And so, you know, when we're talking about other immigrant youth, we're talking about Russian Jews, Italians, Greeks, Armenians, Filipinos, you know, so the list goes on. But yeah, I would say the majority of them were largely Mexican Americans because they were the largest racial and ethnic minority in Los Angeles at the time.
Right. And they stood out too, right? Because of the fashion at the time.
So the fashion we're talking about is jazz fashion. And part of jazz fashion in the 1940s was known as the Zoot Suit. It's popularly known as the Zoot Suit. The kids in Los Angeles didn't call it the Zoot Suit. On the East Coast, it was called the Zoot Suit. But on the West Coast, they called it the Drape. They never called it the Zoot Suit. And it was a fashion that was worn primarily by men, young men. But it was worn across the color line. You had white kids wearing the Drape. You had Mexican-American kids wearing the Drape, Filipino kids, Italian kids. So this was the marker of jazz fans. And this was a fashion that was worn by jazz fans. But you also need to understand that not all youth wore this fashion because it was a very expensive piece of fashion to own.
Right.
It had to be, if you had it made from scratch, it would probably cost you 2 months' wages, if not more. And a lot of young people couldn't afford to do that. So most young people didn't have a Zoot Suit or the Drape. Most young people didn't wear that.
So you're saying...
But the ones who did stand out. You're absolutely right on that. Yeah, they stood out, absolutely.
So there were a number of incidences between Sleepy Lagoon and between the Zoot Suit riots that were essentially clashes between young Mexican-Americans, or youth anyways, and sailors. And part of that was over the excess cloth that was associated with Zoot Suits. Am I correct? Because at that time they had cloth rationing.
The clashes that I found, and I was able to find complaint logs that were issued or filed with the LAPD before the outbreak of the riot in 1943. And in looking at all of these complaints, I was able to compile the very first complaints and the escalation of complaints as well, and where they were happening. And the vast majority of complaints happened between what is now kind of Dodger Stadium, the Chavez Ravine, and downtown Los Angeles. And the reason why this corridor is important was that in 1940, the city of Los Angeles put a military training facility in Chavez Ravine. Now, this is before Dodger Stadium was put there.
Okay.
And Chavez Ravine was always a Mexican-American neighborhood. But there were also a appreciable number of Jews that were living there. Again, because Jews were segregated along with African-Americans and Mexican-Americans as well. So it was unincorporated. So you have dirt roads, you have outhouses as well. And in the city of Los Angeles, in putting this training facility in Chavez Ravine, they exercised the right of eminent domain. So they claim land that families had been living on, kicked them out, and put this, what was then a million-dollar facility. Now, this is $1940, right? So it was a very expensive facility that was to be used for the training of naval officers, which was a segregated military branch at the time. So in the middle of these Mexican-American homes that have been there since the 1850s, you're now putting a segregated million-dollar facility for white military officers. And in order for these military officers to get to downtown Los Angeles, they had to walk through these working-class neighborhoods. And these clashes happened as these white officers were leaving their post and walking the neighborhoods to get to downtown Los Angeles. And so you see these escalating series of clashes as these military men are walking to and from downtown Los Angeles. And now, why these clashes happen, it depends on who you're asking. Mm-hmm. From the perspective of the military officers, it's like, hey, we're just minding our own business, right? We're just walking down these neighborhoods. But from the perspective of the the residents who are living in these neighborhoods. And again, it's very integrated. Majority Mexican-American, but again, you have Italians living there, you have Armenians living there, you have Russian Jews living there as well. From their perspective, these military men are swaggering down their neighborhoods. They're insulting their mothers and their wives and their daughters. And these men are simply standing up for decency and morality by saying to these military men at first, you can't treat our mother this way. You can't treat my sister this way. And so at first the complaints are about verbal harassment. And then the complaints begin to escalate towards physical harassment. And then the complaints then move from physical harassment to actual fighting, fisticuffs, right, before the outbreak of the riot. And so the tensions on the street begin to grow over time. And again, from the military perspective, it's like, hey, we're just walking down through these neighborhoods, we're minding our own business. But from the perspective of these the residents there, it's these military men are offensive. And they're trying to proposition our mothers and our sisters, and the language they use is vulgar, and we're just, you know, we're trying to stand up and protect our families.
Now, how much did the backdrop of being in the middle of a war and nationalistic sentiment play a role in the two sides also having friction?
You know, that's a very interesting question, because using the language of the time, there were people who criticized anyone who challenged someone in the military as being unpatriotic. You know, how dare you do this? This young man is going off to give his life. How dare you push back at this military officer? But, you know, the Mexican Americans volunteered to fight in the war. And in fact, there have been studies that they're among the highest decorated group of people who served in the military as well. So they weren't against the war, and they weren't anti-military. What they were against were assaults against their family and against their norms and their and the decency of their neighborhoods, right? That's what they were against. And so, but, you know, from the perspective of other people, it's like these people are being unpatriotic, right? They're fighting against military men who are giving their lives to defend this country. How dare they, right? So, again, it's one of those complicated strands that get really messed up in this spaghetti bowl of tensions of this period.
Okay,
but I mean, I would say the bottom line is that they were not being unpatriotic. They were just trying to defend their families. But from the other side, people certainly saw that defense of family as being unpatriotic.
So they round up 600 youth or so. They release most of them, but they keep 16 or 17 of them that go on trial. Okay, so they go on trial. Now, do they get convicted?
Well, yeah, I just want to add this part. So they eventually the LAPD eventually and the Sheriff's Department, they focus in on the 38th Street kids, and their questioning is violent by any standard, even more so by our modern standard. I mean the descriptions, and these are coming from the attorneys who represented them. You know, one attorney in particular walked into the room where her client was being questioned, and the young man, his T-shirt was just bloodied from the blood dripping from his nose because he had been beaten so resoundingly by the detectives who were questioning him. And so, and in fact, these kids, when they're on the finally on the witness stand, and, you know, the prosecuting attorney is asking, well, why did you confess? And the kids are saying, it's because we're being beaten up. You know, what else were we going to do? What else were we going to say?
Right.
You know, so I just want to throw that in there, was that, you know, the investigation into the trial was fraught with what I would characterize as misconduct. And I think most people today would characterize it as misconduct. Mm-hmm. Back in the 1940s, this was normal. This was absolutely normal, particularly when you're dealing with minority people. They would just brutalize you until you would confess, because the suspicion was, well, you're never going to confess, even if you did it, so we have to get the confession out of you. So, yeah, so this eventually leads to the trial.
So how did between the conviction, what happened between then and the Zoot Suit riots that led up to a point to where it boiled over so much that you had, you know, the infamous Zoot Suit riots?
Yeah, so the point that I make in my book is that, you know, the murder trial, so the murder trial ends in January of 1943, and the riot breaks out in June of 1943, so it's about a six-month period mm-hmm. between the outcome. Now, it wasn't like the Simi Valley verdict, you know, for example, you know, where you see this immediate response to, you know, the Rodney King incident, right? This immediate response to a trial outcome. It wasn't anything like that. So there wasn't a direct causal link between the outcome of the trial where the young men of 38th Street were all sent to prison of various kinds, depending on, they didn't all get sent to San Quentin. They weren't all convicted of murder of Jose Diaz. Some of them were sent to juvenile delinquency training camps and things of that. Yeah, but all of them were, almost all of them were convicted. There were a few that were not convicted. But there wasn't a direct causal link between the convictions and the riot itself, but they were all part of this larger piece of tensions around the issue of perceived juvenile delinquency and this notion that you've got a large immigrant / refugee population that is a social danger. That's how they connect, because it's all part of this larger discussion and perception.
So you have the Zoot Suit riots. Now, at this time, are those youth still, are they still in jail?
So the 38th Street kids, they're already in some of them are in San Quentin for life. Some of them are in training camps, juvenile, you know, but they're in various parts of the correctional right. system, various avenues. Okay. And they're not on the streets when the riot break out. They're shocked when they read about comes to be known as the Zoot Suit Riot.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what happens after the Zoot Suit Riots?
The riot breaks out. Well, here's my point, is that when the riot breaks out in June of 1943, it was an immediate retaliation against those neighborhoods that lay between the military facility in Chavez Ravine and downtown Los Angeles. That was the first night of rioting when the military personnel attacked anyone they could find on that corridor. That, you know, because that was kind of the corridor of building harassment and tension that had been growing since 1941, 1942. So that was the first night of rioting. But then in subsequent nights, the riot just spreads, and both military and civilians in Los Angeles began to go into East Los Angeles and seek out anyone they could find, but also into Watts, into South Central, African-American neighborhoods as well. And that's when the riot turns from being a retaliatory action against street harassment to being a race riot. There's no reason to target Watts, for example. Mm-hmm. There's no reason to target East L.A. The only reason why they actually took taxi cabs to get there was because they were striking deep in the heart of racialized communities, such as East L.A. and also South Central, into Watts.
So I've always been under the assumption that this moment unified neighborhoods and gangs in a way that they hadn't been leading up to that moment.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, what's interesting is that so this riot was a riot predominantly of both military and civilians, ostensibly attacking anyone they could find wearing the drape. Mm-hmm. But they were happy to include anyone else who either mouthed off or who looked suspicious or who didn't run from the streets. And so the rioting servicemen and civilians didn't restrict themselves only to minority youth. They also attacked white kids.
Working class.
Who were also working class white kids, that's right. Anyone who got in the way. That was the nature of the riot. Now, your question again, I'm sorry, I drew a blank on what you just asked.
I've always kind of put forth the theory that one of the things that changed about gangs in the 1940s...
Oh, it was the unifying. Yeah.
Was the unifying factors that happened in
the 1940s. Yeah. Well, this is what's interesting is that... It, so young people actually fought back, but they fought back in very interesting ways. I mean, they actually laid traps for some of the rioters, and they, you know, we're talking about young, you know, 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds, you know, against 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, you know, who had been trained in boot camp, but they did, they fought back, and they kind of organized in that way. But again, I would argue, I would push hard against the idea that bona fide gangs existed in the 1940s. Again, not in the ways that we think about gangs today.
Agreed. Yeah, agreed. So I feel like it was one of many factors that eventually led to the modern day gangs that we would see now. Now, I use gang loosely when I refer to bands of youth of 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s. We're really talking about neighborhoods and clubs and things like that. But yeah, when you had the Zoot Suit Riots, and things like that, you have these neighborhoods that basically unify in ways that they had not been unified before. Like, now there's direct violence that's happening to them in their neighborhoods. And like you said, the gut reaction is to protect the neighborhood, to protect your family, to protect your name. And yeah, that became kind of a pillar, a moment that would play into the larger creation of gangs as drugs were introduced to the streets later in time, and a bunch of other social factors and things like that.
You know, that's certainly one way of looking at it. I tend to look to a later moment in time when gangs as we know them today, as organized criminal enterprises, and again, I'm thinking about MS-13, for example, I'm thinking about the Bloods and the Crips, the Mexican Mafia, the list goes on and on. I think it was really the advent of cheap street drugs that really kind of put gas to the rise of gangs as we know them today. From my perspective, and this could be one of my blinders, but from my perspective, as I look back to the 1940s, and I would even put this in the 1950s, again, these are just kids who are trying to find their way in the world, quite honestly. You know, 1940s, 1950s, this is the era of segregation. And it's not just racial segregation, it's also economic segregation. And if you're on the outside of what it means to be segregated, if you know what I mean, you know, if you're on that list of people, you know, who have to sit at the back of the bus or sit at the back of the theater or who are denied opportunities, you know, what have you got? You know, and all you have are each other and the friendships that you've got in your neighborhoods as well. And, you know, so I, from my view, I look at the 1940s and 1950s as you know, people just trying to make their way in this world. And things really change in a qualitatively different way, really towards the end of the 70s and into the 80s when you've got cheap drugs that are widely available, and suddenly money becomes a significant factor. And that's when I start to see things changing in a dramatic way, in a way that we recognize now. So
right.
I don't see it quite so much then,
so,
and I don't see the
let
yeah
me throw out some things to you and,
yeah,
and get your thoughts on this. So
yeah,
you had, long before drugs were introduced to the streets, which undoubtedly had a tremendous impact on the evolution of gangs and the violence associated with gangs. You still had the formation of the Mexican Mafia, of you know, various other prison gangs that were formed out of protection. One of
yeah
the things that I thought was interesting is that the group from 38th Street, from the neighborhood 38th Street, that was incarcerated, their cases were eventually overturned, right? And they were released.
That's right, yeah.
Okay. So there
yeah
were, now, that was a pretty big moment when they were released, because,
yeah,
for one, it had solidified what some people had thought, which is they weren't guilty to begin with, but two, they were kind of
right
seen as heroes to other Mexican-American youth when they came out.
Or yeah.
Not. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think that's fair.
Now, I've always wondered, and I've read different theories about this, as to whether or not them coming back out, bringing some of the prison style back out onto the streets, mixing that with the Pachuco style, if that played a role in kind of that you begin to see that formation of that iconic Cholo style, which draws from early
yeah
Pachuco days, and then it mixes prison style. And that
yeah
style blended together is still there today. You know, it's kind of persisted through all those years. And I've always thought that was really interesting. Just the gang politics aside, stylistically speaking, there's no denying that there's, you know, you can trace that to those roots. But I'd be curious to get your thoughts on whether or not their release precipitated anything as a result, or did that add to tensions at the time between sailors, or did it eventually just kind of fizzle out?
For those military personnel that were involved in the riot, they were already off fighting the war, and who knows, I don't even know if they were still alive at that time. So they were gone. In other words, they were gone from the scene, they were gone from Southern California. But I think you're right. I would agree with you that in terms of kind of the prison life, la vida dura, that's always been kind of a tragic reality of growing up racialized and denied kind of mainstream opportunities in the United States, is that, and particularly when you're criminalized, that's always been a part of the Mexican-American experience. Now, in terms of its growing, how do I say this? In terms of that prison culture being a common facet of Mexican-American youth, it's I don't know, I would say it's only a segment. It's only a segment of the larger Mexican-American population, and I think it always has been. It's not to say that every Mexican-American male has been through prison. It's common enough. And in large families, you're likely to have at least one relative who's been incarcerated, but it doesn't mean that, you know, that everyone kind of picks up on prison culture.
Right.
Although I'm speaking, and you know, again, I haven't thought about this. This is a good question.
Well, and I'm not suggesting that's the case. I think about these things. So, for example, I'm really involved with the lowrider community, and I grew up around that. Mm-hmm. And I was at a show, I don't know, a few weeks back ago in Los Angeles, and I was struck, and I always am, on the amount of zoot suits I saw. I was struck on just that longing for the traditional Pachuco culture, and I'm always struck by the persistent style that's associated with prisons, which is you know, the khakis, white t-shirts.
Right.
These are things that have, I mean, lasted a long time. I mean, the stylistic elements associated with kind of that outsider mentality with a subset of Chicanos, right, of particularly urban Chicano youth, I guess you would say, it's been pretty enduring and pretty consistent, and I've always found that fascinating.
I don't disagree with you at all. In fact, as I was trying to think about it, in addition to that, I would add that, you know, for example, the shaved head, the baggy clothing, all of that is a part of that.
You don't even have to be a gang member, I mean, to have a lot of, and that sometimes the shame is that, and I remember when I used to drive my Impala, I used to get pulled over every day in that thing, every day. But, you know, there's a lot of misnomers, stylistically speaking. I think car shows are kind of a good example of that, because you can go to a car show and you could see plenty of people who aren't gang members at all. But I think average people would look at them and assume they were gang members because of how they dressed. And
they're,
you know,
styling,
and there's a lot of little subtleties, I guess, that people aren't aware of, and things that are, they're just little nuances in the culture and in style that the average onlooker would probably miss.
Now, I haven't given thought to when that became a dominant part of Mexican-American culture. So that's a great question, and honestly, I have not thought about that. But to your question, or to your observation about the zoot suit in car culture today, so my observation, and again, I would point out that what they wore in the 1940s in Southern California was not a zoot suit, and what kids wear today is not what they wore in the 1940s. What they wear today is what they see coming out of the creation of Luis Valdez's play and movie. And this is where I try in my book, is I really try and break down the Luis Valdez construction of what a pachuco was. because if you went back in time, if you went back to the 1940s and you asked somebody, what's a pachuco, they wouldn't point to a kid wearing a zoot suit or a drape. That was a jazz fan, and jazz and pachucos had nothing to do with each other.
Mm-hmm. But was it an attitude, in a mindset more than it was a style?
So pachucos, as far as I can determine, the term came from slang for someone who came from El Paso. And depending on who used it, it was either a pejorative term or an ameliorative term. So it was either a positive or a negative term, depending on the context. It could either be calling someone just a hick or someone a dandy, right? So it all depended on the context and the way that you used it. But the drape was not connected with pachucos in the 1940s. Pachucos were something qualitatively different. These are people coming from Los Angeles. I believe that in Los Angeles there was a group known as Tirilis or Tirilones, were probably rum runners. Coming out of the era of Prohibition, they operated on the border. They may have been American Indian. They may have been Otomi Indians. We don't know. But there definitely was a subculture there, and they bore many of the characteristics that are associated with quote unquote pachucos. Mm-hmm. But they didn't wear the drape. Again, I mean, that's a construction of Luis Valdez. They didn't wear a drape.
It's kind of a big thing in the Mexican American community of this identity of kind of feeling like you're trapped in the middle, but you have this tremendous pride of living in the United States and you're proud to be American, but you don't you don't get rid of your heritage, and you're proud of your heritage and your culture. And people seem so confused how somebody can identify as a Mexican American, or they can identify with both cultures. But to me, it makes so much sense, because I mean, for me, that's how I grew up. That's how I've always viewed myself. But you see it with sports athletes who identify as Mexican Americans, or you see people online questioning why is he flying a Mexican flag? He's not proud to be American. Yeah. It doesn't mean any of that.
Yeah. But you and I also live in a time after Chicano nationalism flourished in the 70s and 80s as well, where there was a defined moment where people like us said, this is how we're going to define ourselves on our own terms. Back in the 40s, there was nothing like that. And so a lot of these kids, the 38th Street, who are seen as the quintessential pachucos, they didn't speak Spanish. Mm-hmm. And the only world they ever knew was the United States. And they never saw themselves as kind of cultural freedom fighters. They never saw that. They never saw themselves as striking a blow for, mestizaje or anything like that. We look back through the lens of cultural nationalism to see that. But in my talking to them and in all the articulations I could find from them, that just wasn't on their radar screen back then.
It's really interesting that you bring that up, and I won't go too far into, off the topic, but when you mentioned that they didn't even speak Spanish, that's something that a lot of people aren't aware of with a lot of the gangs in the 60s and 70s before they kind of became what they are now, is for a long time, a lot of the Chicano gangs or neighborhoods, they wouldn't let people in from Mexico. They were, you had to be born in the United States, and that led to the creation of some of the biggest transnational gangs that we see today. Some of them branched off, for example, from Clanton. You had 18th Street that branched off from Clanton. You had, Mara Salvatrucha and all, different gigantic gangs that were essentially made up of immigrants. So I always thought
because of prejudice, sadly.
A lot of people aren't aware of that was happening within the Chicano community for a long time, and probably to an extent still happens.
That's kind of a sad irony.
So how do you see, do you see any parallels between what was happening in the 1940s and what's happening right now? Because when I look at now, I see nationalism. It's not necessarily the direct result of a specific war, but I see nationalism. I see a large debate surrounding immigration. And you almost can never talk about immigration without mentioning Mexican Americans and Mexicans, even though a lot of people coming right now are from Central America, they're almost going through what I feel like what Mexicans had already been through to a large extent. And I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on whether or not we've learned anything, or if this is just something that's just going to continue to repeat itself.
Yeah, that's a famous phrase, that those who don't learn history are doomed to repeat it. Yeah, there are some sad parallels. It's a fine line between nationalism and white nationalism, I would say. It's a very fine line. And so we see the rise of nationalism today. We see the demonization of immigrants, particularly immigrants who are coming in from south of the border. And yes, they are largely Central American and not Mexican American as they were in the 1940s. But yes, we see that same kind of language, that same kind of demonization. So there are some parallels between then and now. Where things are significantly different, on the other hand, is that we don't live with segregation, and I would argue that you and I are integrated in ways that just they could only dream of back then. Mm-hmm. And there's a legacy of that as well. And so, you know, because we're integrated, you know, we have access to power in ways that didn't exist back then. So there are some parallels, sadly, but there are also some significant differences.
I often think about this very thing. I think about the different ethnicities and nations and cultures who have come to the United States, right? You think about the Irish and the Italians, for example, that for a long time, you know, that famous sign, Irish, no need apply. And you have Jews and all of these different types of people who underwent lengths of discrimination before they finally kind of integrated into the United States. You saw it with the Japanese. And I always felt like, for some reason, with Mexicans, it lasted longer, even though there was more of them. You know, you see the Italians and Irish eventually get integrated into the system to where they're not even really considered immigrants anymore, right? People just refer to them as white people. But Mexicans, it seems like that argument has lasted 100 years.
I think it's more varied when we're dealing with the Mexican-American population. So for the Irish, and this is a historical controversy, but I'll stake my part on this because I've actually seen it. I've actually seen into the 20th century want ads that end with "no Irish need apply." So we're dealing with, you know, the early 1910s, and if you consider the kind of the 1840s as the pinnacle moment when the Irish are coming into the United States. You know, that's an awfully long time, you know, to have that overt discrimination towards the Irish, who are effectively white just to look at them, right? Mm-hmm. But are racialized nonetheless in the same ways as many other people. For Mexican Americans, if you want to mark, there are different ways in which you can mark the presence of Mexican Americans in the United States. Some of us were here before the United States came, mm-hmm. but the majority of Mexican Americans came after the Revolution. So between 1910 and 1920, that's when most refugees came to the United States and stayed. So, you know, it's been about 80 years. If you want to start, take 1920. You know, many of us are integrated. But I think what makes things different, though, is that unlike other immigrant groups, because we are so close to the border, we maintain ties with Mexico and with Mexican culture in a way that was not possible for Italians or for the Irish. When they came across, and I would also add technology. I mean, technology allows us to maintain. We can watch telenovelas at our wish, right? Mm-hmm. But if you went back to the 1840s, when you crossed the ocean, that was it. You were never going back, and so the process of cultural assimilation was a one-way street. You just started on that path until your children looked and acted like Americans. Whereas here, culturally, you can still assimilate if you want to, but you know, we still have many, many ties to Mexico, mm-hmm. And there's no need to give up on those ties.
Yeah. I don't think there's any getting around it, to be honest with
well,
you.
Well, I mean, I just don't see any need. I mean, why do I have to? I can still eat the foods that I can go out, I can pay for, you know, I can go to restaurants and eat the foods that I grew up eating, you know. Mm-hmm. Why should I have to, you know, eat at, I don't know, Burger King? You know what I'm saying? You know, I can, you know, you know, I'm teaching my children Spanish, you know. Why? Because we live in the Southwest, you know. I mean, this is just the language of this area, you know. It just makes all kinds of sense. But I have a very good friend who's actually from Northern Ireland. He lives here, and it's very different for him. He's not going back. And I kind of get it from that perspective. Like, if you're not going back to the home country and you've married an American and your children are going to be raised American, you're going to just assimilate like everyone else. But here in the Southwest, you know, we're connected to, we're Greater Mexico. Mm-hmm. And that's just reality. And so those cultural ties are going to be apparent for much, much longer. Well, there's a price to be paid for that. There is. You know, if you want to assimilate into American culture, you can. If you want to act like all Americans, you can. But if you stand out, if you deviate from that, there are some prices to be paid for that. So, you know, we make that choice as Mexican Americans.
Sure. Yeah. And I, you know, I've always felt that part of what makes the West so beautiful is the influence that Mexican Americans have had on it through art,
yeah,
through music, through,
yeah,
food. You know, it's just so beautiful and it's so different. And I always miss it when I travel to the East Coast. Not to say there's not culture in the,
yeah,
East Coast, but it's different. And you grew,
yeah,
up in the West. I'm assuming you grew up. Did you grow up in the West? I know that you're in Arizona.
I
right
did,
now,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. So you understand,
yeah,
that. And, you know, there's just no replacing it. And that's through years and years and decades of influence.
Yeah.
I could probably sit and talk to you all day about a lot of different things. But before I let you go, you have another book that you just wrote last year, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
You want to,
yeah,
tell our listeners about that book and how they can find it?
Yeah, yeah. So this was with the University of Oklahoma Press, and it's called Valley of the Guns, The Pleasant Valley War and the Trauma of Violence. And this book looks at a small community in northern Arizona that just collapsed on itself into a state of civil war. And people who had been living together as neighbors and friends started assassinating one another. And when it was all over, you know, there were 18 people who lost their lives violently. And so I look into, first of all, what happened? How does a community get to that point where, you know, death is the only answer, where murder is the only answer? But I also, what I bring to the table is I explore the role of the trauma of violence in the settling of the West, and how it was a significant factor that really warped the lives of everybody that was engaged in trying to settle the West, from the American Indians to the American settlers as well. It was a significant factor that wounded everybody. And we don't talk about that in our national narratives. I mean, it's always this glorious epic,
right,
you know, of riding off into the sunset. And you know, the indifference to death is one of the hallmark features of Westerns. And that just wasn't the case. People weren't indifferent to death, and they weren't indifferent to violence. Violence had a tremendous impact on everybody, and it warped people. And it then had an impact on their choices and what they did next. And so that's what I'm trying to bring back to the kind of the discussion, is just our appreciation of how trauma was a significant factor in historical events, particularly in the settling of the West.
And where's the best place that listeners can find your newest book?
You know, I think probably Barnes & Noble, Amazon as well. You can find it there.
All right. Eduardo, I want to thank you for coming onto the podcast. This has been extremely informative and interesting. I hope you decide to come back and join us again sometime in the future.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Wow. Well, I don't know about you, but I found that conversation to be thoroughly fascinating, and I probably could have kept it going for at least another hour or so. In any case, I hope you enjoyed the podcast as well. I hope you join us again next week for our next podcast. Until then, continue to visit us at dailychella.com. Also, make sure to follow us on social media at dailychella. Thank you for listening. Have a great week.
Thank you.